It is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And I do suggest you have a pencil and paper handy because there might be something that you want to write down. Could be. The California Native Plant Society Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team would like to invite you to their restoration. It's happening this Saturday, April 20th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. With lots of volunteer enthusiasm, we have made a significant dent in removing invasive non-native French broom from the park, maintaining our current work sites, and making progress on old-growth broom sites. This Saturday's broom bash may be our final project at the ranch before the lack of rain and the heat of summer make it difficult to pull and unbearably hot. Despite these obstacles, many unique and rare species of flora and fauna eke out an existence in the Sandhills habitat of Quail Hollow. I hope you have had an opportunity to visit this special place and enjoy its beauty. We'll return in late fall to start our next round of broom eradication, but this Saturday from 10 a.m., they're going to do it again. How to get to Quail Hollow? Take Graham Hill Road north out of Santa Cruz. As you come down into Felton, turn right at the light and go 2 miles up East Zianti Road. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road. Half a mile on your right is the entrance to Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. And they'll meet in the gravel lot on the left side of the entrance road. The Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitats in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear something, bring something to drink, and let's hope you have lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It won't be raining. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and water. And unfortunately, the program leader, Linda, is out of town. There will be a couple of people standing in for her, so I'm not going to give you her contact information because she's not here. All right. Snapshot Day. The Coastal Watershed Council is going to be having their 14th annual Snapshot Day on Saturday, May 4th. It's only a few weeks away, so let me tell you about it. In partnership with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary and hundreds of community volunteers, the Coastal Watershed Council will systematically sample streams that flow into the Pacific Ocean during this one-day event. They're organizing teams of volunteers to monitor sites across Santa Cruz and San Mateo County. The Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary will organize teams for Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties. You'll be trained in how to collect valuable water quality data such as pH, dissolved oxygen, electrical conductivity, and transparency. You'll also learn how to collect water samples for laboratory analysis of bacteria indicators and nutrients like nitrates and orthophosphates. And you'll get to know why each of these indicators is important to watershed health and be a part of a growing movement, learning what you can do as part of the solution. Grab some friends and family and make it a fun day of caring for your environment on Saturday, May 4th. But you need training. Training is going to happen next Saturday, not this week, but next week, April 27th, here in Santa Cruz from 10 a.m. to 12 or from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Those trainings will take place at the Santa Cruz Yacht Harbor Public Meeting Room, 365 Lake Avenue, Suite A, which is next door to the Coastal Watershed Council. San Mateo, your training is on Monday, April 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the San Gregorio General Store at the corner of Highway 84 and Stage Road, and that's down near the coast. In Monterey, the training will be on Sunday, April 28th from 10:30 in the morning to 12:30 at the RAA store in General Stillwell Drive, located in Marina. And in San Luis Obispo County, your training is on Tuesday, April 30th from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Coastal Discovery Center, Hearst State Beach in San Simeon. And that should be a beautiful spot. All right, get trained, go sample, have fun. Coming up is the 2013 Mountain Justice Summer Action Camp. It'll be happening May 19th through the 27th. Join Mountain Justice this May 19th through 27th for our 9th annual Mountain Justice Summer Action Training Camp. That's taking place near Damascus, Virginia. Mountain Justice has grown from a fast-burning brush fire that helped push mountaintop removal to national awareness into a critical support network at the base of a growing national anti-extractive industry movement for social and environmental justice. This year, it's time to fan the flames of resistance to dirty energy and put an end to mountaintop removal once and for all while continuing to support bottom-up economic transition for a brighter Appalachia. Will you join us as we build pressure and momentum to stop strip mining and other destructive extractive industries in Appalachia? Well, the Mountain Justice Summer Camp is the place to learn skills, expand the ones you already have, strengthen connections in network social movements for justice, meet new allies, and take action to stop the destruction of Appalachia. Workshops will range from mountaintop removal 101 to nonviolent civil disobedience to campaign and community organizing, science and surface mine control and reclamation act, the Appalachian Community Economics. In addition, we're including a more depth in training for trainers to track to help build our collective skills as trainers. Expect direct action to be part of this camp, though participation is not required for camp attendance. Mountain Justice welcomes parents, kids, families, and people of all ages and stages in life. For several years, Mountain Justice events have included a physical space and a crew of people we call the Kid Collective to offer loving and experienced child caregivers and educators armed with books, crafts, toys, games, and quiet space. Please think about bringing your little ones. Contact Aaron at mountainjustice.org if you plan to bring your kids so we can get all the necessary details. The final schedule will be released later, but you can register now at mountainjustice.org. To be notified for updates on camp schedule and other Mountain Justice events, sign up for our news and announcement list. Registration fees are on a sliding scale based on your ability to pay, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. We do provide 3 meals a day, a place to sleep, and amazing trainers from across our regions, so we ask for a donation of between $15 and $50 a day, or for that matter, $150 to $500 for the duration of the camp. We hope to see you in May. For more information, go to mountainjustice.org. Once again, the Mountain Justice Summer Action Camp is May 19th through the 27th, somewhere near Damascus, Virginia. And we'll go to their webpage, mountainjustice.org, for more info. And 3 people have been arrested for blocking Keystone XL pipeline construction. Three lifelong Oklahomans effectively halted construction on an active work site for TransCanada's Keystone XL tar sands pipeline in Bennington, Oklahoma. Eric Whalen, 26, who grew up in McLeod, Oklahoma, ascended 40 feet into the air in an aerial blockade that began at dawn. Gwen Ingram of Luther, Oklahoma, aged 56, locked herself to heavy machinery and shut down the construction site. Also arrested was Stephen Warner, who tried to prevent the arrest of Eric Whalen. Police arrested the 3 blockaders after they delayed Keystone XL construction for an entire morning in Bryan County, Oklahoma. All 3 arrested are lifelong Oklahomans. The Durant Fire Department arrived with an ambulance and a ladder truck to remove Eric from his perch on a tower 40 feet off the ground in the middle of the KXL construction site. In an attempt to prevent them from removing his friends, Stephen Warren tried to lock himself to the ladder truck that they were going to use to pull down Eric with a bicycle lock. However, the Durant fire chief tackled Stephen and threw him over a ditch where police promptly arrested him. Reports from the scene are that the Durant Fire Department was careless in their removal of Eric. The ladder on the truck reportedly bumped repeatedly against support lines that were holding up Eric's tower. Police charged Gwen with trespassing. Eric faces charges for trespassing and obstructing a police officer, and Stefan will face charges for obstructing a police officer and assaulting an officer. We have no idea why that was. The event marks the 4th act of civil disobedience by Great Plains tar sands resistance and comes in the wake of a disastrous tar sands pipeline spill in Mayflower, Arkansas. For the past 3 weeks, over 300,000 gallons of tar sands diluted bitumen has spilled into a residential neighborhood and local waterways. Keystone XL sounded like a bad idea from the beginning, explained Whalen. The Mayflower spill proves that we shouldn't be trusting these multinational corporations like Exxon or TransCanada, because every spill further exposes their criminal incompetence. Now TransCanada wants to build a toxic pipeline through the center of the country. I'm taking action to prevent a tragedy like that from happening in Oklahoma. The tar sands' corrosive nature makes pipelines more prone to leaks than transporting crude oil, as evidenced by Exxon's Pegasus pipeline burst near Mayflower, Arkansas. When spills inevitably do occur, the heavier diluted bitumen sinks in the water and into the water table. Keystone XL's proposed route cuts through the heartland of North America, crossing the Arbuckle-Simpson and the Edwards-Trinity aquifers in Oklahoma. The Keystone XL tar sands pipeline would carry the dirtiest fuel on the planet from Canada to America's Gulf Coast refineries and ports, and then overseas for export, said Gwen Ingram, before locking herself to TransCanada's heavy machinery. I simply won't allow this pipeline to cross our precious rivers, the North and South Canadian, the Red River, the Cimarron, and to threaten our drinking water. And they have now been released from custody, according to an update. And three have been arrested at a court appearance for protesting fracking infrastructure storage site. More than 150 people packed the town of Reading Court in New York on April 17th to witness what they believe is a shocking miscarriage of justice. Three members of a group dubbed the Seneca Lake 12, massage therapist Melissa Chipman of Schuyler County, farm owner Michael Deanan of Seneca County, and Sandra Steingraber, PhD author, biologist, and distinguished scholar at Ithaca College, were sentenced to jail terms for their resistance to the heavy industrialization of the peaceful rural region they call home. What has happened to civil society? Asked stunned Helen Savage when she saw her hero Sandra Steingraber hauled off to jail. On March 18th, Steingraber and 10 fellow residents of the Seneca Lake region, in a peaceful act of civil disobedience, blockaded the gate of a gas compressor station run by Missouri-based Energy, LLP, on Seneca Lake. They were protesting their opposition to Energy's planned heavy industrialization of the Finger Lakes region, renowned for its natural beauty, vineyards, tourism, and agricultural-based economy. And I want to interject here that Uncle Dennis has actually been to the vineyards and wine tasting rooms of the Finger Lakes region, and I might say they grow some mighty fine wine out there, and it would be a terrible shame if they messed it all up as part of this fracking. Moving on with the story. All 11 protesters, along with a legal liaison, were arrested and charged with trespassing. Energy's gas storage and transportation project in the town of Reading, right on Seneca Lake, threatens the water supply for 100,000 people. On April 17th, Judge Raymond Berry of the town of Reading imposed a fine of $375 for trespassing for Chipman, Deanan, and Steingraber, the three people appearing that evening. All three refused to pay. Their statements were made to the court, and the judge ordered that each of them spend 15 days in jail. I think this is an unusually harsh sentence, said Maura Stevens of the Coalition to Protect New York, as it forces working people to give up income, lose time working on the land in this critical springtime, and sacrifices time with their families. Supporters of the defendants were shocked at the judgment and concerned for the health and safety of their friends being sentenced to jail. Sandra was sobbing and hugging her family and all and us in that room off the hallway, said Jan Quarles, wife of Michael Deanan. I've never seen Sandra break down like that before, and I've known her for a very long time. Dr. Steingraber was respected worldwide for her scientific knowledge, eloquence, and commitment to everyone's right to clean water, air, and secure food supplies. Even if someone of Sandra's stature and fame can be thrown into jail because of her reasonable and deeply held convictions, can there be justice for any of us? Asked Jack Dossant, a fellow Seneca Lake 12 protester who had appeared in court 2 weeks earlier with two fellow defendants. Osant and others paid their imposed $375 fine with the help of community supporters. Steingraber, Deanan, and Chipman are in jail now, but fellow activists are holding vigils each evening from 6 to 8 p.m. near the jail. The vigils will continue until they're released. And Sea Shepherd's win is Japan's loss. The Japanese whalers have had their worst whaling season ever. This year, Japanese whalers had their least successful hunting season on record, taking fewer than half the animals they killed during the 2011-2012 season. The Japanese government blamed the meager harvest on unforgivable sabotage by the anti-whaling group Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, an accusation that Sea Shepherd claims as a badge of honor. Sea Shepherd claimed a victory in the ongoing conflict with the whale hunters. It was a short, dismal season for the whalers, who were followed and harassed by four Sea Shepherd vessels across waters off southwest Australia. They returned to Japan with their lowest Antarctic catch ever, just 103 minke whales, far short of their stated goal of 935. The whalers had also set out to kill 50 humpbacks and 50 fin whales, but took none of those. The hunt lasted 48 days, 21 of which were spent avoiding the Sea Shepherd fleet, according to the Institute of Cetacean Research, the official name of Japan's whaling operations. Japan has been engaged in, quote, research whaling, unquote, since 1987, though catches have been shrinking in recent years, largely due to Sea Shepherd's interventions. 832 minke whales not slain, 50 humpbacks and 50 fins not slaughtered, exclaimed the press release from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Sea Shepherd Australia is elated that we have delivered the worst season to date to these whale poachers from Japan. These poachers have shown a complete disregard for cetacean life, human life, and Australian and international law, Jeff Hansen, Sea Shepherd Australian director, said in the release. The lives of 932 protected whales were spared this season, the press release claimed. The loss of those commodities translated into a financial disaster for the whalers, Sea Shepherd asserts. The cost of overhauling just one whaling boat, the Nisshin Maru, cost $24 million, it said. Outfitting, fueling, and operating costs added an additional estimated $11 million. But that figure may be much higher. Going on the conservative estimate of $35 million means it cost the whalers a minimum of $340,000 per whale. There are only two words to describe this: economic lunacy, the statement said. Gavin Carter, a spokesman for Japan's Institute of Cetacean Research, told Take Part that while he could not estimate the loss, obviously there is a research value as well as a monetary one. The illegal sabotage by Sea Shepherd has a negative impact, but I don't have any figure I can give you. Carter added that the Institute is currently involved in a legal action against Sea Shepherd. When asked what message the Japanese government would like to send to American readers who opposed whaling, Carter answered that modern whaling takes place on a sustainable basis and is carried out carefully to avoid impacts on overall whale stocks, he said. The consumption of whale meat is a cultural tradition in a number of countries, including Japan, said Carter. The International Whaling Commission has now updated its site to reflect the latest figures for minke whales in the Antarctic. The new figure is the 550,000 best estimates that dates from 1992 to 2004. Carter also forwarded a quote from Dr. Yoshihiro Fujise, Director General of the Institute for Cetacean Research, stating that more than 500,000 Antarctic minke whales can easily support an annual harvest. A quota derived from this new abundance estimate can be sustainable and have no adverse effect on the Antarctic minke whale. Siddhartha Chakravarti, captain of Sea Shepherd's ship, the Steve Irwin, told Take Part that the whale hunt is an economic drain on the Japanese economy, which is still recovering from the tsunami and radiation-released twin disasters. He said the record low hunt this year will hurt them even more. The Japanese Fisheries Agency and the ICR actually route money from disaster and tsunami relief into the whaling program in the Southern Ocean, Chakravarti said. A recent investigation has revealed that approximately $310 million have been granted in subsidies to the whaling industry. The economy of Japan is taking the biggest hit, with the taxpayers funding an operation few care for. Chakravarti rejected the claims of Japanese officials that Sea Shepherd carried out acts of criminal sabotage on the high seas. Despite Sea Shepherd's successes this season, the whaling fleet rammed three Sea Shepherd vessels and tried to sink one of them, Chakravarti said. And here's the update from the field for the Buffalo Field Campaign for this week. While buffalo calving season has begun here in the Hebgen Basin west of Yellowstone, on Tuesday, Buffalo Field Campaign patrols were blessed to spot not one, but two brand new tiny red buffalo in different locations on Horse Butte. As always, it was a joyful experience and a cause for celebration. The next generation of wild buffalo is coming. But grizzly bears are also awake and active. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols have spotted their huge tracks and other signs in various locations throughout the Hebgen Basin. A few volunteers were even blessed with spotting tracks from a wolf pack not far from our own backyard. But as we celebrate, we also mourn. A solitary bull buffalo migrated north of Yankee Jim Canyon, the government's proclaimed drop-dead zone for wild migratory bison in the Gardner Basin. Along Highway 89, at the tight bottleneck of the canyon where Yellowstone River's rapids get serious, they put in a huge cattle guard and 6-foot fencing that climbs up steep cliffs in both directions. It's there to prevent wild buffalo and who knows what other wildlife from migrating out of the tolerance area. But this bull may never have even seen this blockade. He had simply been up in the hills on the high trails and migrated into the area of Dome Mountain, a place where wild buffalo haven't been allowed to be in over 150 years. A few have made it in recent years, but they've been killed. For a month, he was around the Dome Mountain Ranch, a buffalo-friendly guest ranch. Hardly anyone knew he was there. He was harming no one, living his life and eating grass. But then the Montana Department of Livestock found out. It was as if the troops had been called in for battle. They failed to find him during their first search, and we prayed hard for that bull. First thing Friday morning, they had reinforcements. Wasting no time, but plenty of federal tax dollars, 2 livestock inspectors from the Montana Department of Livestock, 2 Yellowstone National Park rangers, and 1 Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks agents donned their cowboy attire and set out to hunt down this rogue lone wild buffalo. It was 5-1, tax dollars and buffalo be damned. The 2 Montana Department of Livestock agents carried high-powered rifles. The good people of Dome Mountain Ranch refused to allow the Montana Department of Livestock to shoot the bull on their land. Never concerned much with technicalities or buffalo-friendly property rights, the Montana Department of Livestock shot the bull right over the boundary on the Dome Mountain Wildlife Management Area, public land where wildlife is supposed to be allowed. His body was left for scavengers. Maybe because the Montana Department of Livestock was denied buffalo killing so far this year, they were eager to satisfy some of that cowboy buffalo bloodlust. But the Montana Department of Livestock stated that they shot this bull because they didn't want him going back to get other buffalo. They wanted to kill that hard herd memory. But all we know about the mighty buffalo left a scent trail, and buffalo will always find a way. A few mornings later, Buffalo Field Campaign patrols drove down into Yankee Jim Canyon Cattle Guard on Highway 89 to find a mixed group of 41 buffalo contemplating this buffalo baffle. As the buffalo were on and off the highway considering their options, a Montana Department of Livestock agent headed towards Gardner drove right through the group without a second glance. Patrols waited, anticipating a haze or at least some kind of help in assisting these buffalo away from the highway. For hours, no one came. By the time the agents did arrive, the buffalo had already moved away from the road and towards the Yellowstone River. Agents harassed them further from there, hazing them upriver and then across it into Cutler Meadows. Next morning, these 41 buffalo were back. But this time, instead of witnessing another haze, patrols got to see something special that once again speaks to the strong family ties buffalo have with each other. Just south of Yankee Jim Canyon are private lands being leased by the United States Department of Agriculture, APHIS, for their controversial Gonicon Buffalo Population Control Study. Separating 2 of these fields is a corridor that provides public access to the Gallatin National Forest. In one field, Becky Frey, an APHIS bison abuser, was literally inducing abortions in this specific study group. As she did so, the wild group of buffalo moved closer to the fence to check out their imprisoned relatives. Montana Department of Livestock agents also arrived. The buffalo, both captive and wild, came as close to each other as the fence would allow. It was like visiting day at the buffalo jail. Eventually, the wild group continued up the public access corridor and into the hills up to Dome Mountain. Montana Department of Livestock says if they go south from there, they are okay until they get hazed into Yellowstone on May 1st. If they go north, the scent trail of that solitary bull still lingers, as does the vast landscape beyond. And you can align your life with your ideals and come work for the Buffalo Field Campaign. We have immediate openings for field volunteers. Between now and June, we need staff people for our frontline patrols. And come summer, we'll need education and outreach volunteers to represent the Buffalo Field Campaign and Buffalo to Yellowstone visitors. If you're interested, passionate, and hardworking, please visit our website for information on volunteering with the Buffalo Field Campaign. They also have a wish list. Good binoculars are critical for gathering the information we need from a distance. We're asking for outdoor optics, waterproof and multi-coated. Some suggested types include compact and full-size high-resolution binoculars, water and fog-proof 7 to 10x 35 to 70 millimeter magnification. Alpen Optics has generously offered to give us 60% off on 4 pairs of binoculars or spotting scopes. Help us take advantage of this great opportunity by either donating good binoculars or by sending us money so we can take advantage of the Alpen Optics offer. And if you do send a check, write binoculars in the subject line on your check. And send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. And for more information, go to their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and check out their wish list and how to volunteer. And by all means, if you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. And it's always good to remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the Montana-Wyoming Tribal Leaders Council has passed a buffalo resolution. The document calls for viable wild populations of migratory buffalo and for state and federal government to uphold their treaty obligations. The Montana-Wyoming Tribal Leaders Council has passed a resolution on March 23rd, which became available to the public over the weekend. The resolution urges protection of the wild migratory buffalo in and around Yellowstone National Park in Montana. This important resolution was brought forth to the council by Jimmy St. Goddard, spiritual leader of the Blackfeet Confederacy. St. Goddard supports the work of the Wild Bison Advocacy Group Wild Buffalo Field Campaign. Everyone that has a legal right to manage the buffalo are doing wrong, and with this resolution, the tribes have crafted strong legal language to protect and preserve our culture and heritage, said Jimmy St. Goddard. The resolution urges the governor of Montana, the Montana legislature, the U.S. Department of Interior, Yellowstone National Park, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the U.S. Forest Service to recognize and honor their trust responsibilities and treaty obligations to American Indian nations with cultural, religious, and treaty rights and affiliations with buffalo. The resolution urges these agencies to provide for viable populations of wild migratory buffalo or bison in the wildlife species' native habitat. St. Goddard said, this resolution puts the agencies on notice that there has to be legal consultation with the tribes and a buffalo summit has to happen right now. The interagency bison management plan needs to be brought back to the table because it is hurting the buffalo instead of helping them. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We also rebroadcast it at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoons. If you'd like to listen to the Earth First Update on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, you can do so on Monday nights at 9:30 p.m. Their frequency is 92.5 FM. If you want to download or listen online to the Earth First Update, you can do so at the following site, radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. And we do want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for listening.